from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
The worst mistake that the United States has ever made, in my opinion, was going into the Middle East.
That was President Donald Trump on Wednesday at a press conference where he mouthed a number of heresies in front of the world.
It's a quagmire. We are up to close to $8 trillion. We're doing jobs, frankly, that Europe should be doing. We're doing jobs that Russia should be doing, that Iran should be doing, that Iraq, Turkey, Syria should be doing. They should be doing this. We shouldn't be doing it. We're 7,000 miles away.
Also on Wednesday, Russia's foreign minister, Sergei Lavrov, held a press conference in Kazakhstan, where he's visiting, and he was asked about the most recent change in U.S. policy, as had been announced earlier in the week by President Trump.
RT. It's a channel. My question is about the Turkish-Syrian border. I would like to ask what's your personal stance on what the Americans are doing. Donald Trump, as we know, said the Americans don't want to participate in useless wars. And there's information that he was talking about a dislocation. And how can we shape our interaction with Americans? So what's wrong with them?
I find it difficult to tell you what is wrong with the U.S. actions in Syria, but these actions, they contradict each other, and they reflect the fact that it's hardly possible to reach agreement with the U.S. This is clear. For me, this is a fact. Back in the day, we many times called upon the U.S. to stop the illegal occupation of the territories near the Artanf camp, where we created a base. It's a 55-kilometer zone, which is also a place which is now is a safe haven for very bad people, extremists included, people who terrorize the refugees and the internally displaced person who are in the Rukban camp. And we've been trying times and times again to end this camp with the help of the Syrian government and the UN, but the U.S. has many times undermined any promises, as well as it already failed to implement its promise to liberate the territory and that OTAN location. Donald Trump said it would be withdrawing forces from Syria and other countries right after he came to office, but after some time, these promises were not implemented on the ground. Probably now we're seeing the exactly same thing. The Americans should understand that the processes which run in the northeast of Syria because of their reactions in the last couple of years are a direct violation of the UN Security Council resolution to respect the territorial integrity of the Syrian Arab Republic. The Americans organized a quasi-state there, supplying it with all the necessary prerequisites and promoted actively the Kurdish agenda, the Kurdish narrative, and it was doing it in such a way that was met with much criticism and anger on the part of the Arab tribes. That was a very dangerous trend. I've been to Iraq recently. We talked with the Iraqi Kurds, including the leadership of the Kurdish Autonomous Region, and they are very much concerned because of such frivolous treatment with this very sensible issue which can flare up the whole region, and that should be avoided. We've been trying to get that message across to the Americans. We hope that they got it, but in practice we haven't seen any changes. Their policy is as unflexible, as unpredictable as it used to be. We have already voiced our position on the situation in the north of Syria many times, namely near the Syria-Turkey border. And our position is as follows. All the issues should be settled through dialogue between the central government in Damascus and the representatives of the Kurdish communities, which traditionally inhabit these territories. After the exchange of statements, which took place between Washington and Ankara, we contacted the Kurdish community and the government of Syria, and it was confirmed that we continue pushing them towards dialogue in order to put an end to the issues which plague the region, namely security issues on the border between Syria and Turkey. We continue to believe that this is the only way which can eventually lead to a lasting stabilization of the situation. And yesterday we heard a statement of the official Damascus and of the official Kurd representatives that they are ready for such a dialogue. So we will do our best to facilitate the start of such discussion, and I hope that it will be supported by other stakeholders. Yesterday I talked over the phone with the Foreign Minister of Turkey, Mr. Çavuşoğlu, and he resolutely confirmed that Turkey respects the territorial integrity of Syria, and in every action it will be guided by the belief that the ultimate goal is to restore the territorial integrity of Syria. Of course, the situation is now changing all the time, and we will be keeping you posted.
Up next, our weekly drop-in at the United Nations headquarters in New York, with this press conference with the spokesperson for the Secretary General of the United Nations, Farhan Haq.
All right. Good afternoon, everyone. This morning at the Security Council, the head of the UN peacekeeping mission in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Leyla Zerougui, highlighted positive dynamics that could lead the country towards stability and durable peace. She pointed out regional dynamic and diplomatic initiatives and the formation of a new government with an ambitious program to improve governance and promote economic development. However, the special representative added, seizing these opportunities is not without risks and must also translate into relief for the many Congolese who live in a state of insecurity, economic exclusion, and dependency on humanitarian aid. Among the current challenges that need to be addressed is the recent escalation of intercommunal and armed group violence that has led to significant population displacements in Ituri, North, and South Kivu. Ms. Zerougui said the expression of support by the country's partners to find common security responses to the situation in the East is timely and encouraging. Regarding Ebola, the special representative said she is encouraged by the reduction of new cases in the past month, but the battle is far from won, she warned. The humanitarian coordinator for Libya, Yacoub El Hilo, has condemned continued attacks on civilians in Libya and called for respect of international humanitarian law and the protection of civilians. Attacks against medical facilities and health workers have been a growing phenomenon in the Libya conflict. So far this year, there have been 57 attacks on healthcare facilities, resulting in the death of 13 healthcare workers and injury of 47 others. The humanitarian coordinator has urged international parties with influence in Libya to ensure respect for international humanitarian law and to do everything possible to protect civilians, especially children. The people of Libya deserve to live in peace and have a better future. A special report by the UN Human Rights Office and the UN Assistance Mission in Afghanistan examines the impact of civilians on civilians of United States airstrikes on alleged drug processing facilities on the 5th of May 2019 in Afghanistan's Bakwa district and verifies 39 casualties following that operation. Those casualties included 14 children and one woman from multiple airstrikes on more than 60 sites that the United States forces Afghanistan identified as drug production facilities. Moreover, the UN is working to verify credible reports of at least 37 additional civilian casualties, the majority of whom were women and children. The report concludes that drug facilities and associated workers may not be lawfully made the target of attack and should be protected. A new study led by the World Health Organization shows that more than one-third of women in four lower-income countries experienced mistreatment during childbirth in health facilities. The study was carried out in Ghana, Guinea, Myanmar, and Nigeria, and it found that 42% of women who participated experienced physical or verbal abuse, stigma, or discrimination. In addition, 14% experienced physical abuse. There were also high rates of non-consensual cesarean sections, episiotomies, and vaginal examinations. Younger, less educated women were found to be the most at risk of mistreatment. In the study, WHO provides guidelines to hold health systems accountable and give training to healthcare providers to ensure that women are treated with compassion and dignity. UNICEF will now be able to receive, hold, and disburse donations of cryptocurrencies, Ether and Bitcoin, through its newly established UNICEF Cryptocurrency Fund. In a first for United Nations organizations, UNICEF will use cryptocurrencies to fund open source technology benefiting children and young people around the world. There's more details from UNICEF. And in answer to a question we've been asked about a potential tripartite meeting on the issue of Cyprus to be hosted by the Secretary General, all I can say is that no date or location has been confirmed. We're still considering a date and place for the meeting. And on finances, Mozambique has stepped up to the plate. We thank our friends in Maputo for paying regular budget dues in full. This takes us to the round number of 130. And with that, I will open the floor for questions. Do we have any? Yes, Mr. Sato.
Thank you, Hahan. My question is about UN regular budget. Yesterday, the U.S. president tweeted about the UN budget. Not only U.S., but all the member states should pay. What is the Secretary General's response to that? And does UN have any response from the U.S. mission or U.S. government in terms of the shortfall of the budget?
Regarding your first question, certainly the Secretary General agrees with the statement. This is not a question of any one member state. This is a collective responsibility of the 193 member states of the organization. As I just pointed out, 130 of the member states have paid for this year in full. That's a little over two-thirds, and we're very thankful and grateful for that. And similarly, more than two-thirds of the budget is paid, but of course, we're now in October, and we've stated at length yesterday the consequences of lacking the funds that we currently do not have. So all of the remainder must be paid, and we do take this as a collective responsibility, and we're hoping that that all the member states will live up to that. Yes, Majid.
Thank you, Farhan. I'm surprised that in your first statements or any statements, there is nothing from Secretary General about the Turkish operation in Syria. This just opened a big front in the Syrian civil war. Why is that?
Well, as you're aware, we issued a statement on this very topic just yesterday. But I do have something further to say.
This is new. They started.
If you let me, I do have something further to say for today. The Secretary General is very concerned by the recent developments in northeast Syria. Any military operation must fully respect the UN Charter and international humanitarian law. Civilians and civilian infrastructure should be protected in accordance with international law. The Secretary General believes that there's no military solution to the Syrian conflict. He reiterates that only an inclusive and credible political process pursuant to Security Council Resolution 2254 can bring a long-term solution to the conflict in Syria. As the Security Council reaffirmed yesterday in its presidential statement, any solution must respect the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Syria.
Just follow up on that.
Yes.
I want to first ask about any humanitarian update you have so far from OCHA, Syria, and also there's no condemnation. You know, this area that right now Turkey is bombing as we speak, it was stable according to mostly United Nations reports. I'm talking about the city of Qamishli, I'm talking about Kobani. I know this area, all of it was just like 3 hours ago, was stable and now being bombarded unilaterally by one party of the conflict. Why no condemnation for starting a war in an area when there was no war? By the Secretary General, I mean.
As you're aware, we expressed our views on this matter even a day before the current activities. And I've said what I've said in response to what's happened so far this morning. And we are, as you know, continuing to evaluate the situation. Regarding the humanitarian situation, what I can say is that our colleagues on the humanitarian side have shown over the past their ability to scale up in times of crisis on multiple occasions. We've seen this in Aleppo, we've seen this in the south of Syria, and the hostilities in Idlib. We can be prepared if we have the humanitarian access that we need to scale up in response to this current situation. The UN does not have an alternative form of delivery that could replicate the timeliness or reach of its cross-border activities, particularly as access to northwestern Syria for humanitarian partners registered in Damascus is restricted. It remains therefore critical to fully preserve all possible avenues for humanitarian access. Yes, James.
Yes, can I focus on your refrain, there is no military solution in Syria, because you've been saying it for 8.5 years, and all the while we've seen the Syrian government, the Iranians, the Russians, the Turks pursuing a military operation and completely reshaping the map politically and militarily in Syria. So is that phrase not tired? And secondly, on that phrase, if there is no military solution, and that's the firm view of the Secretary General, is the clear inference to that that he's not in favour of a new military operation in Syria?
We've made clear our opinions about all of the military operations, including the ones you've been mentioning. The fact that we have to say it over and over again does not mean that the phrase is tired. It means that the governments and the forces in the region are well overdue in listening to what is the only logical approach. There is a diplomatic solution that we've been pursuing. As you know, our envoy, Geert Pedersen, has made progress, which he's trying to build on, regarding the work of the Constitutional Committee. You yourself have pointed out that there have been many military operations over the past 8 years, and yet, as you see, the crisis goes on, which proves our point. None of these operations have solved the crisis. None of them can solve the crisis. We've been proven correct on this time and again. People have believed that particular offensives could win the conflict from one side or another. None of that has happened, and it will not be able to happen. The parties need to come together. They need to resolve their differences diplomatically. The special envoy is working on this, and we will continue to try to push that. Talal?
Thanks, Farhan. In your answer to Majid when he asked you if there's condemnation for this attack that took place a few hours ago, you said that you spoke about this yesterday, and you have a statement yesterday. But yesterday there was no attack. And shouldn't your statement now be updated to condemn after the attack has taken place? And on the humanitarian level, we can tell you with all sincerity, our people on the ground are reporting about a massive displacement in Kobani. People are moving out of the bombing. And I hope, actually, you are right that your humanitarian response team is ready to deal with such a huge movement of people.
It remains to be seen whether what happens next is of a scale beyond what we can achieve. Ultimately, as in past operations, like the ones I just mentioned in Aleppo and Idlib, we will need to scale up our activities, and we will need support of the member states in order to do so. And fundamentally, we will need humanitarian access so that we can get to the people most in need. Regarding your questions about the wording that we're using, of course, we respect the opinions of the media in terms of your evaluations and analysis of what is happening on the ground. This is a diplomatic organization, and the words we use are the words that we use.
I'm sorry. I have to follow up, Majid. We are not assessing a situation. A fact took place. It is an attack that, for all our eyes to see, and is being covered live on Middle Eastern television networks, including ours, is taking place now. Didn't take place yesterday when you issued your statement. Things has changed dramatically on the ground. Shouldn't you revise your statement to condemn this heinous attack on Syrian sovereign land?
You heard what I said just now, in which I responded at length to Majid's question. Those are the words that we are using at this point.
One more follow-up on this, Farhan. Thank
yes.
you. I just want to make sure I heard the statement right. Is the Secretary General directly asking Turkey to stop this operation and also to make sure that the displaced civilians are safe? Because right now people are running away from the Kobani, from Qamishli, and they don't know where to go. There are reports that thousands of them, they can't even stay at their homes tonight because of the bombardment. So we are talking about hundreds of thousands. Qamishli is a big city. Kobani is a big city. So this is a two-part question. Does the Secretary General ask Turkey to stop? And the second is about the humanitarian situation.
Well, you've heard what I had to say. To reiterate, any military operation must fully respect the UN Charter and international humanitarian law.
So it's
we made clear that civilians and civilian infrastructure should be protected in accordance with international law. And again, the Secretary General believes that there's no military solution to the Syrian conflict. And we reiterate the need for an inclusive and credible political process pursuant to Resolution 2254.
So if the operation is with the framework of humanitarian laws, it's okay to continue. That's what it means, right?
That's not what I've said. Again, I would just leave you with my exact words. Yes.
Thank you, Farhan. The Turkish foreign minister has said that Turkey had informed the Secretary General and the President of the UN Security Council about the start of the military operation. Can you confirm the letter?
I can't confirm the letter, but certainly the Secretary General is aware. Yes.
Going back to the budget issue, it's not your first day at this podium, nor is it Steph's yesterday's first day. And nor has the Secretary General. He's been in the UN system for a while. Aren't you aware that every year the U.S. is paying in November, which is in a few weeks, as opposed to the UN calendar? And therefore, don't you think that waving a red cape in front of President Trump, who is not, to say the least, not very eager to pay international bodies and to be perceived as sucker in his views, in his words. Isn't that counterproductive from the UN's point of view?
Well, first of all, we're not pointing to any nation, as I made clear just now to Mr. Sato. This is a problem that we face year after year. It's true. But the Secretary General has also made the point, and he has made this each year that he's been Secretary General, that every year we get less of the money that we need until much later in the cycle. As we pointed out yesterday, by the end of September last year, 78% of our total assessment for the regular budget had been paid by member states. This year, the comparable figure is 70%. That additional level of shortfall means that we have to scramble even harder to make sure that the basic functions of the United Nations can continue. And that is a problem that will continue the later and later we get the money. We're certainly aware that different member states, including the one you mentioned, have different budgetary cycles. But we need to function all year round. And it's not a question of any one member state. We need to make sure that we have enough support so that we have the funds we need to work all year, not just that suddenly by the end of the year, we're functional again.
To follow up, You omitted another factor in this, and that is that every year the UN budget grows and cuts are rare. So if there is shortage of funds, shouldn't there be deeper cuts?
Well, first of all, the Secretary General, if you look at his remarks to the Fifth Committee yesterday, he proposed a budget that has no real growth. We can't account for things like inflation, but certainly there's no growth in terms of, you know, the real dollar value of what we provide. And he also said in his in that set of remarks that there would actually be cuts to posts as a result of our efforts to maintain a no-growth budget. So please look at his full comments.
But one more thing. I mean, part of the problem as far as the U.S. is concerned is that fairly new thing, which is capping all budgets at 25%, which includes peacekeeping. So as the U.S. cuts its contribution to peacekeeping, shouldn't peacekeeping be a little more, you know, like there are cuts to be made in peacekeeping, according to a lot of observers?
Well, first of all, the budget of peacekeeping missions follows as a result of the mandates given to them by the members of the Security Council. As a result of that, it's the member states, through the General Assembly and its bodies, notably the Fifth Committee, who approve all these budgets. Once they've approved those budgets, they have to give us the money to fulfill those. We're not the ones setting the budget of the UN. The member states do that. If they ask us to do these functions and they give a level of money for us to fulfill those functions, then they need to provide the money that they've said that they'll give us.
To be continued.
Yes, Maggie.
Farhan, Undersecretary General DiCarlo is in Beirut today. Any chance she'll go to Ankara? And any updates on any phone calls the SG has had or any senior UN officials on the Syria developments?
No. Obviously, we're in touch with officials at various levels. And as you're just pointing out right now, Ms. DiCarlo is in the region herself. I don't have any changes to her travel plans to announce. Mr. Badi.
Thank you, Farhan. Still on the situation in the northeast Syria, there are indications that some states aware of the situation and concerned about it are preparing to have the council meet and study the situation. Are you aware of that?
That's always a possibility, but I can't announce that. That would be a matter for the president of the Security Council to announce if they're having anything. Yes, please.
Thank you, Farhan. Is the Secretary General concerned that the start of the military operation might now postpone the launch of the Syrian Constitutional Committee?
We certainly intend to go full speed ahead with the launch of the Constitutional Committee, and we're continuing with that process. Mr. Peterson is going about his work, and we certainly hope and expect that this process will continue. Alan, you had a question?
Thank you, Farhan. Just to follow up Petul's question, you've said that the Secretary General is aware of starting the military operation of Turkey, but I just wanted to ask you to clarify whether he was informed before the start of the operation, at the moment of the starting operation, or after the start of the operation. Could you clarify, please?
I wouldn't be able to provide the exact timeline. He certainly was aware this morning of the start of operations. Yes, please.
Amit reports about targeting civilians and Turkish military attack on Syria, and there is concern of genocide, a kind of genocide or ethnic cleansing. Is there any urgent action that you can take to stop this assault?
Again, I've mentioned that any operations should follow both the Charter and international humanitarian law, and I would reiterate that point. Yes, please.
You talked about a fund from UNICEF in terms of cryptocurrencies, but there are a lot of countries which still have legislation which is not supportive of cryptocurrencies. How is this fund going to work in that regard?
Initially, I believe UNICEF has been saying that it will work in four different countries where the UNICEF committees have support for this. So those countries will be France, the United States, Australia, and New Zealand. And then we'll see whether it expands from there. Have a good afternoon, everyone.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.